astrology is a very integral part of the Rosicrucian philosophy, so much so that the Rosicrucian philosophy has to be a church because of astrology. Because according to California state law, you cannot send out astrological lessons unless it's part of a religion. That's why you have several places like the First Church of Astrology in Los Angeles and places and things like that. Astrology and the philosophy are so closely entwined that it's almost impossible to separate them. Cosmological astrology, which has almost nothing at all to do with horoscopes, is found throughout the cosmo conception, especially in part two of the cosmo conception. Everything in the cosmos has character, and the character is denoted by planets. Like a period of time has a character, and that may be called the Saturn period. Or a period of time may have the character of the moon. We talked about that yesterday when we said that the desire body was developed in the moon period, because the moon has that watery feeling nature to it. It's motive, it stimulates. Gordon yesterday talked about, he gave me an excuse, the reason why my talk yesterday wasn't so hot was because the moon was void of course, and there was nothing to stimulate interest, and so everything went this way and that. So everything in the evolutionary creation has character. In fact, that's one of the chief ways you can understand that something is evolved, is the degree of character in it. So the stars, everything has character. Now, horoscopy, which is what most people consider astrology to be, is an integral part of the Rosicrucian philosophy, even though some people don't know that. Now, in the talk yesterday, previous talk, we talked about how the moon works with the desire body, which was begun in the moon period. And the moon gave its character to the desire body. Now, the desire world, the human desire body, showed that astrologically. But in the desire world, Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that there are two forces, attraction and repulsion. Everything in the desire world is objective. That desire relates to an object. And how it relates to that object is how the motive force is directed. For example, if the subject sees an object outside and it reaches out and asserts itself to take that object to itself, the ingoing force produces an outgoing force of repulsion. And the outgoing force of repulsion is equal to the amount of selfish self-assertion that something is taken, that someone takes to oneself. On the other hand, if one gives of oneself and lovingly pours out, this sets up an attraction that things are attracted back to the subject. So that we find people who are very loving are people, everybody wants to be around them. You want to be around somebody who loves. Now, this was evident, though it wasn't stated this morning, when Earl was talking about greed. In the case of greed, the subject has an emptiness, has a weakness, or has a feebleness. It feels unfulfilled. And therefore, it sees all of those things outside that are desirable. So the internal emptiness causes this whole greed, I have to take something to me, and it's constantly pulling things to itself. And nobody wants to be around a greedy person. They're not they're not pleasant at all. And since desires can never be satisfied, the more you assert a desire, the more you're going to tend to want to assert that desire. When you live in the desire, the greed will never be satiated, no matter how much you have. There are people that have millions of dollars and they're afraid to spend any of it because they're trying to hold it all to themselves, and they're trying to fill up an emptiness with a desire, and that desire can't satisfy anything at all. Now, this is something that you can't see always the lines of force, but it can be seen. This is how the Rosicrucian philosophy developed. The adepts, who we call the elder brothers, are people who, through clairvoyance, saw how things work in terms of desire. Now, we don't have time to go into this in great detail. We did that a couple years ago, or we at least did a little more. But let's look at some of the astrology of how this works. Now, you take the simplest keywords, like in Message of the Stars, there's a list of keywords for each of the planets, and you start applying them and putting them together with the desire world in mind, and the astrology of the desire world and the desire body become very clear very quickly. Now, if you look, Max Heindel's favorite word, keyword, that opens up the sign Aries is self-assertion. And his favorite keyword for Scorpio is repulsion. Now, both Aries and Scorpio are ruled by Mars. Therefore, the strength of Mars in a horoscope indicates the quotient of self-assertion repulsion that a person has. It is, the horoscopes that we're going to look at are really simple, but it works with any horoscope. If you go through and compare the strengths of all the planets by looking at their aspects and positions and everything, a rough outline of how to do that is also given in Message of the Stars. No, it's given in Questions and Answers. And when you do that and you find people who have strong Mars, very assertive and usually very repulsive. In an analogous way, Libra rules self-sacrifice for the other. It's always giving. Libra is a sign of the arts. It's something that pours out from itself and tries to make the world a more beautiful place. The favorite keyword of Max Heindel for the sign Taurus is attraction. Now, Libra and Taurus are both ruled by Venus. So you can say then that the quotient of self-sacrifice and attraction is indicated by the strength of Venus in a horoscope. Now, if we had more time, which everybody should take time in this way, we could go into this in great detail. And it's like everything else in the Rosicrucian philosophy. The deeper you delve into it, the richer it becomes, and the more practical things you can get out of it and use in your daily life. Let's do one little detailed thing further. Aries and Libra are both cardinal signs, which means they indicate the type of action that you take. Whereas the fixed signs, Taurus and Scorpio, represent the kind of field. Any physicist can tell you that when there's an action of some type, whether it's electrical or kinetic, when there's an action of some type, it sets up a field around it. So the attitude of action indicates the attitude of the field. And so there are even more things that you can look into this. And it's quite elaborate. It gives you a very good understanding. So if we take Mars and Venus together, like yesterday we took the Sun and the Moon together as planetary opposites, and we saw that that indicated the line of light. The one being the positive light, the giving light, the other being the reflective light that is more protecting and nurturing and more caregiving kind of light. So what we're looking at today with Mars and Venus is the line of desire, how desire works in someone's life. Now, in saying all these things, we're only talking about the basic energies, the forces, the force of attraction and repulsion. We're not talking about all of the flavors. If a person has a very strong Mars and they're assertive, but yet at the same time there's a lot of Jupiter, the Jupiter will give you flavor, and it will be a bombastic, a very wide-reaching kind of self-assertion. So the whole flavor, the whole spectrum of color is in the desire world, but the basic lower desire world is ruled by Mars, because that's the only part of the desire world where there is self-assertion and repulsion. Whereas in the higher desire world, there's attraction throughout the desire world, but in the higher desire world, it is pure self-sacrifice and attractiveness. So we can say then, when we're talking about Mars and Venus, we're talking about the line or the pole of desire, and that line or pole of desire is the pole for the whole desire world. If you like, we can go into a little bit more detail. At the very bottom of the desire world is Saturn. The action of self-assertion is indicated by Mars, but the end, the very bottom of the desire world, is selfishness, and that's ruled by Saturn. So that the most base and the darkest kinds of desires are Saturnian types of desires. That doesn't mean that Saturn doesn't also have good desires, but if you're looking at the darkness in somebody's aura, you're looking at the Saturn. On the other end of the desire world is Jupiter. And Jupiter is the most generous and the most giving. It gives everything for everyone. And so that end, the Venus end, at the end of the Venus pole is Jupiter. So it has always been the tradition of all astrology, as long as it's been, that the malefic planets have been called Saturn and Mars, whereas the benefic planets have been Venus and Jupiter. The ends that one seeks, the objectives that one seeks, are from at the ends in Saturn and Jupiter, but the actions and the attitudes of the actions that one takes to attain those ends are indicated by Mars and Venus. Well, we should almost be ready to look at some horoscopes. Huh? All right. Pass them all, please. Again, we have to say what we're looking at when we're looking at these horoscopes is very shallow. It doesn't even qualify much as astrology. Some of the people here sit through classes that have been running 5 or 6 years, and when we look at one horoscope, we spend as long as 12 or 13 hours put together working at that one horoscope to really understand what helps that person to help understand how a person functions. All right, is everybody set here? The first horoscope is the horoscope of Robert O. Anderson. Everybody knows who Robert O. Anderson is. He's Eddie's cousin. Robert Anderson is somebody that we chose to be an example of self-assertion. If you look, Mars is in Aries, and it's conjoined to the ascendant, so this is obviously a go-getter. He was born to wealth. You look, there's some, both Jupiter and Venus often have to do with wealth, and they're both in the first house, and Venus in the first planet in the first house indicates that wealth comes to him easily. But his father was a banker, but he made it on his own. The sun is in the first house, and when the sun is in the first house, and especially so in Aries, this is the indication of a self-made person. Sun in the first house, almost always self-made person. The Aries represents the desire to go for whatever one sees in one's vision. In fact, you can manipulate Aries quite well by just putting different things in front of their vision, and they'll go after that until they tire of it, and then you put another one in front of them, they'll go after that. Now, everything in this man was like that. He was a restless, self-assertive man. In his education, he studied the humanities. That Venus came out. He studied the arts. He even wanted to be an artist, but never became one. But at the same time, he had a strong interest, indicated by the Mercury conjoined Jupiter, in things like philosophy. He studied Freud. He studied Marx, and he loved Aristotle. So he loved challenge. All of the fiery signs, especially Aries, like challenge. And his specialty was taking old and broken down businesses and buying them up for cheap rates and then renewing them. Not remodeling, but renewing. As we see in, like, for example, our equinox services. Aries, at the time of Easter, is the time of renewing. Aries loves new things. It's almost a faddist sign. If you find a combination with a lot of Aries and a lot of Gemini, you're going to find somebody who likes all the new fads. So he started out with two broken-down oil companies, one of which was in New Mexico, where you don't find many oil companies. And he ended up owning the majority of the stock of Atlantic Richfield Corporation. He ended up being the chairman of the board and the chief executive officer. He was the first one. Aries always likes to be first. He was the first one to bring in Alaskan oil. But he had other interests. He was on the board of the Chase Manhattan Bank. He was on the board of CBS, of Weyerhaeuser Lumber, and the First National Bank of Chicago, to mention just a few things. At the same time, he was also interested in charitable organizations. He asserted himself everywhere. And the consequence of that assertion was attraction, which comes from the deeper planets in the first house, the Taurus parts. Now, Mercury in the first house is sextile and trine to Saturn and the Moon. And if you look at Saturn and the Moon and you put them in the horoscope of the United States, they fall right on the oil-rich resources in the United States. Taurus also, as we know, rules cattle. It's the sign of the cows. And this man, at one time, by his self-assertion, took up cattle raising as a hobby. And I don't know if it's true to this day, but he owned more land in the United States than any other human being. His combined ranches in Texas and New Mexico were over 1 million acres. So this is an assertive person. He never lost his interest in art. He is an avid collector and has obviously a multi-millionaire collection of art. And when he heard about Harper's Magazine going broke, he bought it just to keep it alive because he still maintained his cultural interest. This is true self-assertion. This is what the desire body is for. The desire body is to motivate us to do things, and we'll go after this and this and this and this, and he was like that. There are a lot of sextiles, the Sun and Venus especially, to Uranus, and that indicates inventiveness. And the squares to Saturn indicate the selfishness. Now, he did not, because he intentionally chose to stay out of the public eye. His repulsiveness does not show up as much as his self-assertiveness. It's there, though, because he's a Bilderberger, and probably Lou is the only one in the room beside myself who knows what a Bilderberger is. The Bilderbergers are the ultra-rich of the world. They don't really belong to any country. They belong to their wealth. They're called Bilderbergers because the first time that they met at the Hotel Bilderberger in Holland. They met a few years ago near the French Alps, and they had, when they all came together, the security was so tight that they had tanks surrounding where they had their meeting, and the direction that the economy of the world is going to go is determined by the meetings of the Bilderbergers. I think they take turns between Coca-Cola and Pepsi, and I think usually it's about 5 or 6 months after a Bilderberger meeting that it changes. And the downfall of Russia, after one of those meetings, Russia suddenly started allowing Pepsi-Cola in, and that was the end, that was the beginning of the end. It rots more than your teeth. All right. Well, we don't spend too much time here because we're running behind time already. The next horoscope is the horoscope of Ada Byron. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy and astrology teach that when you're reborn in a male body, you're more responsive to the Sun and Mars, which are considered masculine planets. Whereas if you're reborn in a female body, you're more responsive to the Moon and Venus, which are considered female planets. Nonetheless, if you have a strong Mars, as there is a strong Mars in this horoscope, there's going to be responsiveness anyway. This is the only legitimate child of George Gordon, who we know as Lord Byron, the famous romantic poet. Her mother divorced him several months after the birth of the child because she thought he was insane. He was pretty wild out, pretty far out romantic, wild, doing all of those kinds of swimming the Bosporus and doing things like that. He was not an everyday person. So she divorced him so that she could have custody of the child. The divorce probably happened when the moon progressed over the ascendant, because then the moon was in the first house and her life was then dominated by her mother. Her mother was a very powerful woman and moved in the highest echelons of British society. So growing up as a little girl, she sat on the knee of Charles Dickens, or she would be with Michael Faraday or all of those luminaries. The idea of her mother was kind of martial. She wanted her daughter to either be a mathematician or to be a metaphysician or a scientist, anything but a poet. The idea worked perfectly. Now, this person has the Sun in Sagittarius and in the ninth house both. And she loved mathematics and she loved abstraction. They were almost thinking like she could be fascinated and spend hours at it. And they were conjoined to Neptune. So she was indeed interested in metaphysics. And its horoscope was so accurate is in that she liked to spend a lot of hours with horses. She was one of those horsey women. I have a lot of friends that are like that. Mars rules energy. So she was restless also and very energetic. But with the strong trine to Neptune, she was allowed to sublimate her energy into abstract things. And this wasn't just let me go after this thing and that thing and that thing. It was I get interested in things outside of me, but I sublimate them into an abstract way. So she became interested in liking new things. She was an enthusiast and she was a futurist. So she was a Neptunian type of visionary. She became a very close friend of a very famous Cambridge mathematician. And that mathematician was a futurist himself because he didn't just diddle with formulas. He made a computing machine. My friend Shard is a abstract mathematician, and I have to tweak him a little bit because it brings him down to earth. It was Babbage, Edward Babbage. So he started making this differences machine, which is something like our, Shard won't like this at all, it's something more like not a digital computer, but an analog computer. It approximated, and mathematicians hate approximations. They say we leave that to statisticians, the people who don't have it, who can't make it in the precise world of mathematics. They're kind of priggish, these mathematicians. But at any rate, he made the first proto-computer. It was a mechanical computer, and it was not an electronic computer. And they were such good friends, he asked her to make written notes about his computer. And she got enthused. And she wrote three times as much about the future of the computer as she did describing his machine. And in her enthusiasm, she predicted almost all of the things that came to pass in the computing industry, including computer graphics. She really was a futurist. But genius isn't known for longevity, and she died before she was 37 years old. She had cancer. But she was an excellent, martially flavored person. We won't say a whole bunch about the next horoscope. It isn't really strongly martial, but it is repulsively martial. Have any of you ever watched Monty Python on television? In Monty Python, they had these two kids that, how did Monty Python say it? They said it was, they were born on probation. And what they were talking about was this man, Reginald Cray, and his brother, Ronald. They are infamous infamous Cray twins who grew up on the East End of London, which is the very down and out violent, all the boxers and such, all the poor people come from the East End. They were children of an army deserter. And they themselves deserted from the army several times. It almost got to be a cat and mouse game. They'd catch them and bring them back into the army and they'd desert all over again. I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time because they're not really pleasant to deal with. Mars identifies with energy. And it likes competition to see who has the most energy. But when it becomes morbidly attached to an energy, the consciousness that is asserted in that kind of way produces a cruelty. When a person identifies with defeating the opposition, it becomes a very cruel person. This is the horoscope of a very cruel person. The twins were extortionists. And they ran cheap gambling dens that the high and the mighty would come to slum at. So they made a lot of money. the Sun is in the fifth house and Jupiter's in the fifth house, so they were in the entertainment business. And the Sun is in Scorpio, which means cruelty. And the Sun is square to the Moon between two very cool or cold signs, Aquarius and Scorpio. So there was a kind of cold, detached kind of cruelty that they had about themselves. So they specialized in sleazy entertainment clubs. Mars is in Aries. When Mars is in Aries, it can be very constructive. But when Mars is in the other fiery signs, it tends to be cruel. It tends to be pugnacious. And it tends to be really nasty. They were both boxers, which is the way they got into extorting people. Like either give us money or we'll beat you up. They're so cruel that in one of their slummy nightclubs, even with celebrities and people around, Reginald held this guy who was giving them trouble, and Ronald stabbed them to death in front of hundreds of people. And nobody would testify against them. So for years, it was an unprosecuted crime, until finally they didn't treat one of the gang right, and he betrayed them, and he gave 200 pages of testimony. And they were given the first true life sentence to never get out of jail in England, because England does not believe in life sentences. And Ronald, who died in jail, and Reggie was released to die of cancer shortly thereafter. So that's the negative side of Mars. Let's look quickly move to the next horoscope. We're not doing too bad on time. Linda Evans. This is to show that there's a hard sign even in women, those who are reborn in female bodies. In this case, we have Mars is in Scorpio, Mercury, Sun, Venus, all Scorpio, the ascendant is Scorpio. She isn't necessarily repulsive. She appears attractive, but she isn't good to be around. She's a tough person, a very tough person. And you know what she says? She uses astrology as a cop-out. She said, I went to see an astrologer, and the astrologer told me to be more assertive about myself, and I owe my strong character to astrology. She won't own up to this. She didn't need the help of an astrologer, not by any means. This is another self-made person, and the self-made person is determination. The first planet is Mercury, so this is another child prodigy. She isn't especially brilliant, but she was a child actor, started at a very early age. The Mars, which we're looking at, is square to Pluto. And that indicates very strong-willed determination, a tough person. Mars and Pluto are the planets, for example, of dictators. Every time that Mars conjoins Pluto, every couple of years, at least every time I've looked at it, I don't look at every one in the newspapers, but under that conjunction, it's always when they declare martial law and somebody takes over. And so she had to have a religion that was tough. And she is a follower of Ramtha, who is this 35,000-year-old warrior who channels through Jay-Z Knight. And has a whole following of strong women around him. There is a benign and generous side to her also. The Sun and Mercury are both trying to Jupiter, so there is something very generous. Just as a little aside, she had two marriages, and you would expect, only the order is reversed. Her first marriage was to John Derrick, and John Derrick is a was a handsome movie star that took beautiful young blonde women and made stars of them. The first one he did it with was Linda Evans, who was about 20 years younger than him. And then later on, he married Bo Derek. Remember that movie 10 that came out many years ago? That was, he made her into a 10. He's the one that actually started the rating system of women from 1 to 10. Isn't it nice to know that you're mathematical and that you have numbers about you? But at least, at any rate, when Saturn is in the seventh house, there are often differences of age between the person and their marriage partner. I'm marrying this 20-year-old woman next week. No.
And where doesn't show the longevity of her glamour? Because I understand she was 50 when she got into the dynasty.
Yeah. I don't know. I would say that from the Scorpio rising. When I Scorpio does have an ability to hold itself young. When I lived at Mount Ecclesia, there was a man there that had Mars conjoined the Moon in Libra, but he had five other planets conjoined in Scorpio. And he was in his 70s, and he looked like he was in his 40s. And he had studied with an Essene group at one time, and he had learned meditational exercises for how to control the thyroid. And he was a phenomenon of a person. Everything Scorpio that you can think of. He was a bartender for Al Capone in a whorehouse in Chicago. And he was a boxer that could take a punch, and he would take punches to go. Everything you could do to make a person stupid. And when I met him, he wanted me to teach him astrology, and he couldn't even multiply and divide. But he kept himself young in that way, and that's very often either Aries or Scorpio have that youthful quality. In this case, Uranus in the seventh house indicates something very futuristic. Because for her second husband, she married a man who was much younger than her. She married, do you know who Yanni, the New Age musician, is? She married Yanni. He's her boy toy. Well, he's no longer a boy. All right, let's look at the next horoscope.
What was Saturn in the seventh house?
Differences in age in marriage. All right, we have moved into the Venus half of the desire world. Does everybody know who Gabrielle Fauré is? I take all these people who are perfect examples and who I think everybody knows, and it turns out nobody knows them. We'll just go on ahead anyway. This is a Venusian horoscope. There are three planets and the ascendant in Taurus. And in this case, the form of attraction that is Taurus is composition. This was a composer of music. The first planet in the first house is Mercury. And again, we have a child prodigy. He won all kinds of child organ recital things. He had all of the education of other composers of his time, such as Debussy, but he always tried to do something different every time that he wrote a piece of music. And this was quite difficult for him to do, because he was trained to be a composer and teacher of religious music. His parents were very conservative. This is shown by the Pluto conjoined Jupiter. Pluto and Jupiter put together make somebody that is extremely orthodox, if not reactionary. And this is the kind of background that he had to the Taurus first house kinds of things. There are sextiles in this horoscope of Jupiter and Pluto to the planets in the 11th house, Saturn and Neptune, which showed that even despite all that conservatism, he could be quite successful in doing new things. However, it wasn't pleasant for him to be restrained by the church as much as he was, and he always felt constrained. So in the Saturn and the Neptune square the planets in the first house in the same way that the Jupiter and Pluto sextile them. So there's an internal struggle of being innovative, but also having to pay for it personally and having to be in a church almost all of his life as a church organist, and eventually made it to the Paris Conservatory. But all right, but I don't want to go on too much. The sun represents self-identity. It is how you see yourself. And it is conjoined to Venus. That is its strongest aspect. He identifies himself with beauty. He wanted to do beautiful things. And he wanted to have beautiful things around him. This was his form of attraction. And so he also has a love for words, because Venus is Mercury is in Taurus, and Mercury is conjoined to Venus. So what he set out to do is to take beautiful poetry and set it to music. Now, this is not something new, but the way he did it is different than everybody else, the way everybody else around him did it. Most people just find music that the words flow with. You know, it's sort of the words float on top of the music the way a boat floats on top of the ocean. But what he did is he tried to penetrate into the thing that the poet was trying to say but really couldn't get into words. He wanted to add something to the poet that the poet couldn't do because of the limitations of poetry. And he was very successful because he understood the relationship of music to words. And a number of poets came to him and said, "You have said with your putting the music to my poetry, you have done what I wanted to do but could not do myself." It's quite a remarkable person. He even had remarkable words to say. He was vacationing on the mountainside and he wrote to his wife, "I have just begun to write a string quartet without a piano, which is that form of music that Beethoven mastered so well that anybody who is not Beethoven feels funky trying to write." Yes. That's part of the innovativeness too. A very inventive man. Genius in many ways. Considered a little too eccentric, but it's all right. All right, the next horoscope. This is the horoscope of one of the most beautiful women in the world. It is also the horoscope that is almost a perfect example of what we're trying to look at, and that is the relationship between love and attraction. Libra is rising, and that is the signature of someone who is often beautiful. It's also the sign of sacrifice for the other. It is other-oriented. So it's no wonder she's attracted. Venus, who is the ruler of the ascendant, is in the seventh house, which is the other-oriented house. And it conjoins Uranus, which indicates Venus and Uranus together is hyper-romantic. And you can see that she has one romance after another because the Aries interest wears off and she falls in love and falls in love. You can't, the rose does not always stay in bloom. So she can't, so, you know, she wants something new. So she's had seven marriages, and then one of the husbands she married again. Now, it's the thing about people who are actors. People who are actors can't always, because they're making sacrifices, especially in these days at the stage when you had to travel a lot, you couldn't live out all of your life like other people do. So what happens with actors is they live out different parts of their character, by the roles that they take. And so she got to live out parts of her life by some of those roles. Now, it's not surprising that she played Cleopatra. Historically and in literature, especially in Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, which is a delightful play, Cleopatra is the ultimate Libra. She invents new ways to titillate her lover. Like she has Antony doing this and that and that and that, and she can't do it for herself. But because she loves someone, she finds exciting ways to keep them loving her and to keep them amused. So we can see then that this is, you know, that this is a creatively attractive person. And you got to like someone that you don't know them all at once. You know, this is what happens when people get into carnal knowledge. When they get into carnal knowledge, it is said that you know your partner. And if you jump into a relationship and it's immediately carnal knowledge, the knowing is all done. You know, it's all taken for granted after that point. In this case, the Uranus and Venus are trying to Jupiter. And this means that she's exceedingly... And Jupiter is in the 11th house, which means that is indifferent giving. It's not personal giving like the fifth house. So there is an element of not personally being involved in a lot of the giving. So that's another reason why she is as attractive as she is. Venus and Uranus also square Pluto, so there's a little bit of obsessive loving here. She does get involved with all of that. Five planets in the fifth house, which is even more giving. She isn't really always discriminate about her giving. She gets sometimes confused, and her compassion goes out in cases when she shouldn't go out. I guess somebody has to love Michael Jackson. It's tough business. So you can see from all of the giving, both personal and impersonal, that she is likely to be attractive. She's a perfect example of the Rosicrucian philosophy about attraction. And there's one other feature about this that is quite good. She has the moon at 26 of Scorpio, which is right near my very strongest Mercury, which is my life ruler, so there's still some possibility for me. Yeah. When I was a young man, I had a crush on her. I saw her in that movie with Montgomery Clift, who she fell in love with, but he didn't reciprocate because he was gay. And in that movie, she was in the prime of her beauty, and her eyes were almost purple. She was such an extremely beautiful person. All right, let's look at the next one. This is somebody that everybody knows, I hope. This is the horoscope of someone who is very remarkable as an artist and as an inventor, but who has had to do a lot of struggling in both art and invention. The struggle comes from the Venusian planets, the Taurus, Moon, Mars, and Venus. Mars and Venus are square to Uranus, which indicates his technical side of things. Unfortunately, the Uranus has a much stronger trine to the Sun, so his electronics and his technical things do him excellently well. But the Taurus planets, sextile Mercury in the third house, and Venus sextiles Neptune in the fourth house. So we're talking here about
technology. This is somebody that's both an engineer and an artist, which means he plays beautiful music but wears white socks. This is a man that still plays music. Once a week, he goes to Manhattan, and he goes to a jazz club, and he's in his 90s, and he plays jazz. And he's playing new kinds of jazz because his fingers are now so arthritic he can't get the grip on the guitar that he used to get, so he has to learn different kinds of grips, and he's inventive in that. Now, this is somebody that has been a world-class musician, and he's been the friends of all the big-time musicians of several generations. He was very close friends with Bing Crosby. He was very close friends with Judy Garland. And all of the rock musicians, Eric Clapton and people like that, they all had to make their pilgrimage to make a friendship with Les Paul. He had a very close friend who always came to him for personal advice about what he should do with electric music. Jimi Hendrix was a friend of Les Paul. So he's been first class in music, in country music, pop music, blues music, rock, jazz, everything. Now, his spirited giving, and it's spirited because Mars and Venus are together, this is what makes for art more than almost anything else. What I found in looking at charts of great artists is that there is a strong Mars and a strong Venus. Because if you have just a strong Venus, you have somebody that understands delicate music, but there's no guts to it, you know, that it has no strength. You have somebody that's just Mars, it's all just mechanical. But when you have the two of them together, it really makes for success in music. And his is like that. He's a very spirited person. He's really the inventor of the electric guitar and the perfecter of it because he was a musician himself. But the Gibson Guitar Company didn't do anything to promote him. And instead, another company put out the Fender, and that became the popular guitar until Gibson finally did something about it. And then all of the musicians knew what you could do with his guitar. It's called the Pulverizer. But this, yeah, he actually used a log before he later called all of his guitars logs, because there are things that you can't do if you have a pickup on an acoustical guitar. You cannot get the sounds that you can get with an electric guitar, and I think some of them you shouldn't get, but that's neither here nor there. But he really perfected that. Clearly, he has a lot of fame, a lot of fortune. He's considered a great... And by the way, he did have a terrible accident from the Mars Square Uranus. His car went off a bridge or something like that. He fell 60 feet, or maybe even more than that. I tend to understate these days more than overstate. And he lived through it. And though he had a lot of broken bones and such, he came back and played guitar some more. Let's look at the last one, so we're not too overstayed. This one I don't expect too many people will know. Does anybody know Rosa Bonheur? I didn't think so. This is the horoscope of a famous painter. And she was in French painting when Impressionism and Abstraction broke away from the School of David. But she was still representational. In this case, Libra is on the ascendant, and Venus is in Pisces. So we have somebody that has a very delicate aesthetic. She has four planets in Pisces, which indicates even greater tendency toward delicacy. The Sun happens to conjoin Pluto, which indicates a little bit something strong, forceful in that. We'll get back to that in just a little bit. She didn't like the traditional landscapes and portraits because they didn't have enough energy. This is somebody that wants to have energy and delicacy. Even though she was raised to be an artist, she was fascinated with structure, the relationship between structure and action and the beauty that can be found in action. She's famous for quite a few generations now for painting animals. And she's more capable of showing the action in the animals than almost any other painter. And she actually dissected dead animals to see how the structure was. The structural understanding is from the planets in Capricorn. Capricorn is like the skeletal structure of things. And on top of that, she took trips through slaughterhouses. And she would just to see how the musculature of the animals worked. And she would sit and watch animals for hours. She loved animals and she loved animatism. And it's so fascinating. Her father wanted her to be an artist and he gave in to every one of her wishes. And when she was growing up and even into her young adulthood, into her maidenhood, on a sixth floor apartment in Paris, right in the center of Paris, they had a sheep because she had to have animals that she could watch. And she loved sheep, and she loved to paint and sculpt. There's a famous sculpture that she has of a sheep. All right. She tried also to communicate spiritual power, and that's where the Mars Pluto comes in. The Pluto part became very strong. And when Pluto and Neptune are very strong in a female's chart, especially when there are a lot of aspects to Venus, there's a tendency to lesbianism. And she had her repulsive side. Despite all of her love of beauty, she smoked and she drank, and she didn't have any conventions, didn't have any care for convention at all. And she would pray to her young lovers, lesbian lovers, in all of the finest restaurants and such like that in Paris. And she got away from it. All right, that's as far as we'll go today. Let's close with the Rosicrucian prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
The last sentence that you had was something about Mars and Pluto, and I didn't quite catch what you said.
No, it was about the Sun and Pluto. It was having to do with power and the assertion of power. The sixth house is how things work, its function.
Sun and Pluto in the sixth house?
No, yes.
Sun and Pluto in the sixth house.
Fascinated with the distribution of power in how things work.
And what did you say was lesbianism?
Anytime there are a lot of strong aspects to Neptune and or Pluto in a female's chart, especially if Venus is in the mix. Most common. There's no absolute signature for anything. Either Pluto or Neptune. Anybody want a set of the... yes, please.
Okay, strong aspects to Pluto and or Neptune.